It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, it's often said that Anchorage is the largest village, by which people are referring to the fact that there are more Alaska Natives living in Anchorage than anywhere else. But we all know that Anchorage actually isn't a village. Anchorage is a city, and the experience of living here is pretty much the urban experience of living almost anywhere else. So I want to talk today with two Native leaders about what is the urban Native experience. Boy, we spend a lot of time in the media talking about the rural Native experience, but this is a topic that really doesn't get much discussion. And along the way, I really want to dip directly into the subject of racism. I've become aware, I guess I always was, but increasingly aware, of the racial discrimination the Alaska Natives face. And I want to have an open discussion of that, and I want to hear from visitors, listeners, about what you think of that topic. So I've got a great pair of guests for you who are both friends, and I think we can have a really good, mature discussion on this topic. Daley Sambo-Duro is the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, a representative and a UAA professor, and grew up in Anchorage and still lives in West Anchorage. Thanks for being here, Daley.
Thank you.
And Jim LaBelle is retired, mostly, still has a lot of things he's involved with, was an early leader with Chugach Alaska Corp in setting up that corporation, has taught at the university on Native corporate leadership, and long and deep experience in the Alaska Native community with a lot to share. Thanks for being here, Jim.
Thank you, Charles.
And we're going to very much welcome your calls, regardless of your race or perspective. It's an open community discussion. Here, the phone number is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Daley, I launched into the word racism right at the top. It's a difficult word for a lot of people to talk about. But I know that in your work with the UN, it's a subject that you work with and try to understand and try to deal with. It makes sense to start sort of defining what racism is.
Okay. Indeed, the work that I've done at the international level with Indigenous peoples across the globe has really been about countering racism and its impact on Indigenous peoples. And in this context, in 1965, the General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. And this international human rights treaty includes a specific definition of racial discrimination. And I'd like to read it out because it provides an important context. And it's Article 1, Part 1 of this international human rights treaty. It states, "In this convention, the term racial discrimination shall mean any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on race, color, descent, or national or ethnic origin, which has the purpose or effect of nullifying or impairing the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise on an equal footing of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, or any other field of public life." And that's a very, very specific and explicit definition. Again, the distinction based on race, color, descent, national, or ethnic origin.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to agree with your opening statement that it is unfortunately alive and among us, racial discrimination in the Alaskan community, the broader community, and it manifests itself in a wide array of ways.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think, and I wonder if part of that goes back to our theme about the urban experience, because in rural Alaska, Alaska Natives tend to be the majority, and in some ways the majority sets the tune in a community. But in Anchorage, although this is originally the land of the Dena'ina, Alaska Natives are the minority and can be excluded and pushed aside and minimized in a way that they might not be in rural Alaska. And so that may be a part of the, would you agree? I see you nodding that sort of racial discrimination is more a part of the urban Native experience than it is the rural Native experience.
I would say generally that yes, it is, just because of demographics and also, membership and living within a community, living within a village, living and being a tribal member within an indigenous community is dramatically different than what most Alaska Natives encounter in urban areas, whether it is Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau. And we're actually seeing some differences in terms of demographics in some of our larger rural hubs, like Barrow, Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel, and so forth. But no, I would absolutely agree with that statement, mm-hmm. and not as a generalization, but I think a fact, just in terms of numbers and how Alaska Native people, as individuals, but also collectively, how they're perceived by others.
Yeah. Jim, what do you, I know you and I have talked quite a bit about this issue in the past, and I profiled you in my Anchorage history book, mm-hmm. when I talked about kind of the rise of the Native community in Alaska, and in Anchorage in particular, where we went from the Alaska Natives essentially being a marginalized people in terms of economics to being owning the biggest, most successful corporations in Alaska, which is a great success story, but also potentially is a story of that creates resentments. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about what that experience is all about in terms of if there's a factor here of the majority feeling like, why is this minority taking things over?
Well, certainly there's stereotypes about Alaska Natives being wealthy, and I've heard this myself. Alaska Natives are rich, and it's a generalization based on some regional corporations handing out just tremendous amounts of money to their shareholders. But the real story is that very little of this so-called wealth is really getting distributed across the board. And so all we hear about are just the exceptions.
That's right, yeah. Which are easy to, if somebody says, well, I don't get money given to me, so therefore.
That's right.
Yeah.
And also I think we need to understand too that Anchorage is, in my opinion anyway, is more transitory. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people coming and going in and out of Anchorage from the lower 48. And my take is that many of them come from places where maybe racism is a little more blatant or accepted or practiced. And they come to Alaska and they don't know exactly how to apply that to the minority population.
Yeah.
So, and Anchorage, of course, is so diverse. Ethnically diverse, and so I've heard and ran into friends and folks that were told that they were being thought of as Natives themselves when actually they may be Pacific Islanders or from someplace else.
Yeah, Filipino.
Filipino. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the other thing that's a very unfortunate, difficult topic to talk about, but I want to just go ahead and dive into it, is on one hand, people thinking Alaska Natives are privileged because of the corporations. On the other hand, seeing the public inebriates on the street corner, who unfortunately are many are Alaska Natives, and this stereotype is created, like the drunk Native and so forth, and which seems to be, when we talk about what are the negative racial stereotypes that are put on Natives, that seems to be what people focus on.
Oh yeah, and it just doesn't stop with that. It's across the board. Natives are dirty, they're uneducated, they're angry, there's a whole array, they're drunks, of course. and that is the most visible signs exhibited by maybe just a very few people, and then they generalize to make it applicable to all of us.
Yeah. So do you have anything to add on that, Daly?
No, I would agree with that commentary, and I think that we see it in so many different forms, and I think the main message in encountering that perception of Alaska Native people is the fact that, like any society, you have a broad spectrum of individuals, and it is absolutely clear, yes, there are inebriates here, many of them, and thank goodness for people like Samuel John and the Forget-Me-Not initiative that he has put together. Many of those individuals, on face value, may appear as though they aren't contributing anything. Whereas once you get to know these individuals, and that's the beauty of Samuel John's work, is that they're extraordinarily knowledgeable. They have skills and capacity that outmatch many non-native people, mm-hmm. And the I think that the forces working against them are the ones that establish what is seen on face value in contrast to who those individuals actually happen to be. And I think that it's also important to recognize that the intellectual capacity reflected in individuals like Jim, the other Alaska Native people that have gone away, received an education, coming back, making a contribution, those Alaska Native people that are, in fact, genuinely active within the village corporations, the regional corporations. In every walk of life, there are Alaska mm-hmm. Native people doing extraordinary things. And more often than not, they're discounted, and the value that they add to our community is discounted and very rarely recognized for what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, even today on a Facebook page, people congratulating a new PhD, an Alaska Native with a PhD, and there is a growing and very deep pool of such individuals that are not splashed on the front mm-hmm. page,
and it's super exciting, and I see that happening too. One of the insights, and I'm going to give out the phone number because I know we don't get too deep in our discussion without getting some other people on board with us. But one of the things that I've noticed recently since I've been writing for Alaska Dispatch, and they have the comments at the end of the article, is that virtually any article that even mentions Alaska Natives, even if there's no aspect of it that's about Natives, but just simply a Native name, will have often have a long string of really racist comments. Newspaper goes to a lot of effort to delete those, but they can't be deleted immediately. And what I've learned from that, since I'm not Native and have not been subjected to anti-Native racism, is the sort of the virulence of it and the fact that it really has nothing to do with any reality or. Like you're talking about, well, we have PhDs as well as we have street drunks. Well, it almost doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter who's doing what. Mm-hmm. There's just an awful lot of people out there with a lot of hate who feel entitled to spew it out. And I find that really interesting because it seems socially unacceptable to do that with any other race. But for some reason, people feel it's okay to do it with Natives. And I think that's a weird part of our society that's really unfortunate. And somehow or other, we got to deal with it. I don't know, Jim. Do you see that?
And yeah, I see it also. And I think there's a lot of reasons, but the ones I'll mention are there's fewer of us in numbers. We are definitely not only ethnically a minority, but we're smaller in numbers from the general population, and we have fewer people in government and in the legislature that have the capacity to address some of these issues. And so we're having to deal with some of those on that level.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to point out, though, that it has extraordinary historical roots and antecedents in terms of discovery and the Catholic Church's response, the responses and efforts by early scholars like Bartolomé de las Casas, and who were grappling with the fact that these people are different, and out of this, and the so-called discovery of the Americas and indigenous peoples throughout North, Central, and South America, but also globally, that the how indigestible it is to white people to accept the difference of indigenous peoples, and in our case, Alaska Native people. And so those doctrines of superiority and the use of terms like barbarians, savages, and so forth, it remains with us and is really the undercurrent to the virulent racism that we see even here today in 2016. A colleague and friend of mine, Rob Williams, has written a book called Savage Anxieties that traces the use of this term going back to its earliest origins, but then brings it forward to the present-day context of treatment of indigenous peoples, whether it is in international law, in economics, in every possible field, this notion that indigenous peoples, including Alaska Natives, are somehow inferior. Hence my desire to point out how, in fact, many are quite extraordinary and superior in many ways.
Yeah. I'd like to add to that, even Sheldon Jackson in the late 1880s, in his own writings, referred to Alaska Natives as savages. Mm-hmm. And he took that mindset back east when he rounded up the various denominations from the National Council of Churches. And so I'm sure he also let them know how he felt about mm-hmm. Native people. But it was all designed to, he was carving out enclaves of different church groups that were going to descend as missionaries on Alaska.
Yeah. Interesting. I've been studying some of this recently as I've assisted the State Museum in Juneau with the new exhibits that they're setting up there, which will be opening, I guess, next month, and really didn't focus until recently on the fact that it's the centennial this year of Native Americans in general becoming citizens. 101 years ago, Native Americans couldn't be citizens and really couldn't own the land, couldn't vote, couldn't do all those other things that you normally do. Incredible. Yeah. So anyway, our conversation today is about the urban Native experience in Alaska. And I have two guests in the studio, Jim LaBelle, who is Chugach Alaska Corporation, one of the founders and is now retired, and Daly Sambodoro, who's our own Alaskan UAA professor and is also representative of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And we welcome your calls and comments on the urban Native experience and this racial conversation we're having in general. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. So one thing that I wanted to bounce off my guests is the different social structure of the village and the city. Our sort of basic social unit in the city is the nuclear family, which is, you know, from the dominant culture. You have your own detached house and you live inside it. And then maybe you reach out and have aunts and uncles over for Sunday dinner. Whereas in the village, there's more of a tribal structure where a lot of the responsibility for raising kids is shared among a lot of families. And there's a lot of sort of mixing of families, and sort of everybody moves off to fish camp at the same time. And I'm just interested, I don't know who wants to take this one first, but how does that translate between the village and the city? I mean, is there a sense that that the social structure is different among Native people in Anchorage? And how do different different families negotiate that? You're both handing that to each other, but that's something I've never really discussed, I don't think, with either of you, and I'm curious about it.
I The social structures that I can recall, because I did at various points in time lived in villages. I lived in Norvik for a year, so long ago, and I lived in my wife's village of Port Graham for 3 years in the 70s, and I think the elders in my wife's village sensed what a lost person I was for a lot of reasons, and took time to educate me into the ways of you know, what is it like to be an indigenous person, because I didn't have that perspective. And the bonds and the connections are still there even after I've moved away for so many years. And we do go back and forth. And so we do have that relationship, but primarily with the elders. I don't have that kind of relationship with some of the younger people. And I mean younger, I mean in their 30s and 40s. So it is different. They don't seem to have that kind of sense of relationship that I had with elders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Julie?
Yeah, on that note, I think that what you've pointed out in terms of relationships and lines of communication in rural areas in contrast to being in an urban area, my own experience has been that though we live in Anchorage, most of the people from Unalakleet know who else is in Anchorage from Unalakleet.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they've maintained ties. Actually, a group of them from Unalakleet and Norton Sound generally, this kind of ironic, by virtue of the Covenant Church, have been able to really maintain close collective ties. But on a more micro level, in terms of my own family and extended family, the bond that Jim has just spoken of and connections remain. They're stressed and strained just by virtue of people's work, but when I was younger, certainly I recall any hunting trips which my father was involved in, which included my brothers, also involved other extended family or people from Unalakleet or other Alaska Natives that they happen to meet and form a bond and friendship with through their experience at Mount Edgecombe or elsewhere. And so though we live in an urban area, these ties and kinship are still critical and still important.
Mm-hmm. And subsistence, of course, is another tie that kind of binds us together, both from rural and urban communities. And I think one would be surprised at just how much traditional foods get shipped here and there.
Yeah, yeah.
Across from villages into the region, into the city, and vice versa.
Let's take a listener's call now. Caroline is on the line from Anchorage. Caroline?
Yes, hi, Charles. You've heard me say before the thing I liked about Fairbanks when I first got there in 67 was that it cut through all the racism I'd grown up with in the South. There was no classism or what's the word for female? Anyway.
Sexism.
Yeah, thank you. At 40 below, and back in those days, we didn't have cell phones, and of course they can drop out and not work now. You didn't care, and it was the underlying feeling that caused even those who may have had racist thoughts to give expression to them, because everybody was in the same freezing boat together. And so I regret that we don't have a spate of minus 40. But the other thing too is I don't think the young people, and the gentleman mentioned that some of the young indigenous people don't understand the connection to their elders. But I don't think a lot of people know that the indigenous people of this country had a higher per capita volunteer rates into our military. and subsistence. I mean, I was thrilled when a friend sent me some muktuk, and there's nothing like herring eggs on spruce boughs.
So I agree.
These kinds of things, and the people have such a respect for the animals that they take, and nothing is ever wasted. And I encourage people to go down to that park just below Simon and Seaforth's and look at the birch trees, and they'll see a ring of darker birch, grayish. And in case they want to know, were the native folks here in this area? Yes, they were. 50 and 75 years ago, the women made a very thin cut for their birch baskets, for the materials for their birch baskets. So living with nature and not having to kill it in order to survive has been something that I have always admired.
Yeah, that's very true. And all of Anchorage, of course, was the land of the Dene'ina, and the Klutna village is still there. They haven't disappeared.
Yeah, and one final thing. Yeah. I think somebody needs to take a look, and I'm sure some of the folks have, at the results of shoving the indigenous people of the Brazilian rainforest into cities. It was disastrous. And the lungs of our planet are being destroyed by the trees being cut down.
Yeah, so, okay, good points, Caroline. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
I want to take up one of the things that Caroline said, which I think is interesting and somewhat ironic, is that Native cultures are sort of one of our biggest tourist attractions. And one of the things that people kind of, when they talk about being proud of being Alaskan, sort of the Native cultures and sort of, have you ever eaten muktuk? Have you ever, done this or that? It's sort of part of the sort of being, what's cool about being Alaskan, right? So on the one hand, there's this racial prejudice against Alaska Natives. On the other hand, there's this sort of pride and sense that that's what Alaska is really all about. And I don't know if I have a question about that, but I think that's an interesting aspect of this whole experience. Although it has the flip side that it's the desire to make it into culture, into a museum piece, right? And it's not real unless it involves drums and regalia.
I think that the willingness and oftentimes individuals moving in faster than the speed of light to exploit and appropriate culture is, while at the same time wanting to deny the economic, social, political dimensions of the lives and rights of Alaska Native people as human beings is probably one of the certainly one of the most visible examples of the type of racism that we see. I mean, the willingness to
Give us an example of what you mean by appropriate.
Let's see. Well, we have the Ulu factory.
Yeah, right.
The recent news article on the use of other Native designs, and so in terms of intellectual property and knowledge, indigenous knowledge, we probably don't face it in the same way as we've seen the pharmaceuticals active in Brazil and other parts of the world in terms of indigenous knowledge and exploitation at that level. But there a range of different examples of appropriation, but also exploitation in terms of Native culture. But at the same time, and they're and happy and put on a pedestal in terms of culture and cultural expressions. But at the same time, when it comes to issues of justice and access to justice, why is there a disparity? Why are there more Alaska Native men in prison for a same or similar crime? Why are health conditions, the disparities related to particular health conditions, why does this disparity exist if, in fact, we want to embrace the culture?
Right.
We
want to embrace it sort of as something to put on the tail of an airplane, but not to actually engage with and think about in a serious way. Yeah. And at the same time, I feel like one of the things I like about our culture is that people do kind of share cultural influences, and that you can have, somebody who's I had a guest who was Alaska Native artist who was making use of Japanese culture and sort of including Japanese and Native motifs in the same work. And I wouldn't want to say you can't do that, right? So it's a complicated and slippery issue of like both respect and wanting to somehow share and yet keep our own. And so it's a good discussion. We've already half done, believe it or not. And so we're going to take a quick break, come back with my guests, Daly Sambo-Doro, who's UAA professor and representative of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and also a lifelong Anchorage resident. Jim LaBelle, who is a founder of Chugach Alaska Corporation and is still in Anchorage, is in retirement and speaking out and helping a lot of folks with his knowledge. And we will welcome your calls. I'll give out those phone numbers and email address when we come back from this short break. Please stick with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about the urban Native experience, which inevitably relates a lot about race and racism, but also a lot of issues about what that experience is like, how it's different from living in rural Alaska. We're going to talk about the corporate and tribal ways of looking at things and a lot of other things. It's going to be it's a very quick hour with my guests, Daly Sambo-Doro and Jim LaBelle. And we invite you, whether you're Native or non-Native, if you have any perspective on this or questions for our guests, let's broaden the discussion. The phone number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. And you can reach us by email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And happy to read those messages on the air for my guests. And all comments are welcome. It's a big issue, and we've got some great guests, but other perspectives are welcome as well. So in 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act passed, and the 40 million acres of Alaska that transferred as sort of a settlement for the taking of Alaska from Alaska Natives was put into the hands of Native corporations, which was a kind of a brand new idea. A lot of the kind of imported ways of governance, of voting for town councils or voting for corporate boards of directors, were not really that much in line with the way Native had organized themselves previously. Of course, there are a lot of Native cultures in Alaska, and they all had different governance structures previously. Jim, you were involved in that, and you were there when President Nixon signed ANCSA and said, okay, here you go, folks. Before we go too much farther, I mean, just what was that like? That moment must have been amazing. What a historic moment.
Yeah, it was very, very historic, but I have to let everyone know that I wasn't involved in the fight for ANCSA.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I was there.
You're too young.
I was in the military at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was a young student at Alaska Methodist University when Nixon did sign ANCSA, and there was all these wonderful leaders from all over Alaska, Native leaders in the audience, in the room. And it was so palpable. It was the culmination of how many years of effort. And I can still remember one Native leader saying to another, what do we do now?
Right.
And so I guess that part was where I came in and I got involved at Chugach in helping the villages, our five villages, get established under ANCSA, help them with their organizational meetings or filing of their articles and bylaws, helping them select their leadership and get them on the road to selecting their lands.
And this and setting up a new way of governing, right? Because I mean, traditionally there was kind of governance by chiefs who were essentially chosen just because they're respected in the community, and then you move to a system where people are elected and they hold offices and they have to have proxies and all that. Was that kind of a difficult transition?
Actually, in the beginning, a lot of the tribal leaders were the leaders in ANCSA as well, and the transition faded over time and new leadership came on.
Mm-hmm. Daly, how do you see this? I mean, there's been so much discussion about which is the right way to for the Native world to be governed through tribal organizations, through corporate organizations. And, of course, there's sort of the whole state and local government structure. A lot of choices. It seems like a lot of villages are horrendously overburdened with different structures. They've also got the nonprofits. You know, everybody in the village is on three or four different boards. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I mean, should we move more towards tribal governments? I mean, what does that mean?
First, I want to say that I would agree with what Jim has just identified in terms of the early leaders and the people that were respected and stepped up to try to grapple with the very complex provisions of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Mm-hmm. And I think that the other thing that's important to acknowledge is the land. And that being the central focus of the so-called settlement, and I put it in quotation marks because I think there are a wide range of issues that are not settled and remain outstanding.
All right, let's come back to that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the land and securing rights to the land is an important and central aspect of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The remaining provisions are highly problematic to me. Mm-hmm. In terms of my analysis and how, in fact, in the context of this rural Alaska Native and urban Alaska Native, this discussion, they're exacerbated by provisions of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And I think that in direct response to your question about the vast array of institutions that have grown up around small rural Alaska Native communities that were traditionally tribal, that I think that the pathway forward is going to tilt and lean more steadily and maybe incrementally toward tribal governance, and especially in rural areas where we see this. I mean, even public safety, that's a perfect example where you have a community of 300 or less. You have a village public safety officer. You have need for measures for social control. There is absolutely nothing wrong with recognizing a tribal government who takes on the responsibility for measures of social control to safeguard its people. And I've never understood why this has become such a contentious issue in terms of state authority and jurisdiction and tribal governments and their status, their authority, and absolutely, they should have jurisdiction over something as simple as public safety and the safety of the members of your community. And I don't think that there is I don't think that the corporations created by ANCSA and or mutually exclusive, and tribal governments. I don't see them as mutually exclusive. I think that, in fact, during the time that I was involved with first the Alaska Native Coalition, which actually was a coalition of tribal governments and village corporations who were equally concerned about the amendments to ANCSA because they wanted to safeguard the land, and the voice of the Alaska Federation of Natives, which was oftentimes characterized by at least the very aggressive tribal government representatives involved in the Alaska Native Coalition as the corporate cartel. It seemed to me that, you know, these two points of view that clashed in terms of the lobbying effort in 1986 and 1987 to amend ANCSA. And my question was, why is there such a
why clash?
Why clash? And you know, we were trying to articulate something as ridiculous as a qualifying transferee entity, because the corporations, AFN, and others couldn't accept the use of the term tribes, when in fact you had the tribes either as Indian Reorganization Act, you know, IRA councils, or as traditional councils.
Some of this is probably getting over our listeners' heads at this point, or at least because of some of the terminology is not familiar to people. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about is the ability of people to continue to identify as a tribe while at the same time owning the shares in a corporation, and that those don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for simplifying that. Yeah. No, and because I think that they can work hand in hand to meet the economic, social, cultural, civil, and political desires, rights, and aspirations of their people.
Right. So one of the, you know, when we think about the Anchorage experience, you know, there is a sort of governmental structure here which is sort of can't be ignored, you know, the local government and state government, school board. We have one Native person who's on the school board, the first in a long time. I don't believe we've ever had an Alaska Native on the Anchorage Assembly that I can recall. We've never had a Native mayor. We have a small number of legislators, I think maybe one Native legislator from Anchorage. Obviously, very, very underrepresented in terms of numbers. And I wonder if you guys have a sense of why that would be the case, because I don't know how, you know, Natives are a minority, but a Native candidate who ran would presumably have some support, you know, kind of depend on the person a little bit. But have you thought about that? Why that nut has never been cracked in terms of a local government or in Anchorage, where there's a really the largest minority is Alaska Native? Jim, have you thought about that?
I've thought about it, but at the same time, I'm trying to recall if there was any Native person that attempted to run for city office, and I don't know if you could have one without the other.
Very few. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then that asks another question: Why is that involvement not there? Is it a matter of folks already are involved in their church and in their Native community and their, you know, tribal groups, and so they aren't interested in being involved in local government? Or is it a sense of exclusion that not being part of that group? I mean, in terms of a town that's 38% minority, we sure aren't anywhere near 38% minority in terms of leadership of any of our local institutions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're welcome in that world, or maybe already busy in the world that you're participating in? What do you think, Daley? Would you ever consider running for local government?
Yeah, you know, I've been urged to in the past. I don't know that I would. I don't think I'd ever volunteer for something like that. in part, I think it's because it's not an institution that is native to me, you know what I mean? It's an institution where, and I see it at the international level in terms of negotiating the content of indigenous human rights standards. It's the, to join a government delegation would be, I would not even think of something like that. So I think there's a measure of that, at least for myself.
To simply not identifying with that institution as being yours.
Yeah, personally and on an individual basis. I see the need for it. And anytime anyone steps up to the plate, it's like more power to them. But for myself, I wouldn't be comfortable.
I wonder if it's you're not alone in that, though. I mean, you may not be the only one who feels that way. Jim, what do you think?
Well, I think I hate to make generalizations again, but on the other hand, our culture, our traditional culture, is so different from those European structural setups and institutions, and which I perceive as built on conflict. And as a rule, Native people don't like that kind of divisiveness. They would rather find consensus. In fact, many traditional organizations operate by consensus building, and getting on the city council or the school board, I think oftentimes is based on the clash of ideas and egos and that kind of thing that could, you know, sway things.
Yeah, I think that I agree with you. I would maybe take another step further, which is that the sort of the dominant culture is based on individual, and the Native culture is based more on the group and communitarian ideas. But one thing that as long as we're pushing uncomfortable topics, I mean, one thing that I've noticed that I am completely confused by is that when in Native politics within Native organizations, despite what you're talking about, the fact that people don't want conflict and they have these communitarian values, when you get a Native corporation that's having a leadership fight, that's like the nastiest, most brutal fight that you've ever seen. And I've always wondered, I've never obviously been in the middle of that, but I've always wondered, what's that all about?
Yeah, if you look in the dictionary, you'll see my picture.
Do you have any insight on why that is?
I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with trying to understand the nature of how to incorporate these Western style institutions into our Native value system. There might be a sense of before ANCSA came along, I think there was this feeling that everyone was equal, everyone was the same. And all of a sudden, as a result of ANCSA, you have boards of directors, you have officers, and it's the setting above or setting apart that starts to create conflict, because at one time we were pretty well more or less all together and equal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would add that the imposition of this Western institution of a state chartered corporation has definitely created the disparity that Jim spoke about at the outset of this program, and that's the matter of the haves and the have-nots. Originally ANCSA was supposed to guarantee our economic security into the future, yet at the same time we have extraordinary rates of poverty. We have all of the other spin-off effects of poverty by at least Western standards, and the indicators as far as health and I could go on about the range of social ills, but getting back to this, the point you've made about the hostility in terms of proxy wars within these corporate structures, I think far too much of it pivots on money and mm-hmm. who controls the money. Mm-hmm. And I have run as an independent candidate in the corporation that I am an original shareholder of, Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, and I have seen things that would shock many others.
Yeah.
There is, in my view, in my perception of things, there is very little corporate social responsibility. There is very little corporate democracy. And it comes down to who's going to maintain control. And it's that that pot of money and who's going to control it. I was a persona non grata. In fact, I probably still am. It's a good question to ask some Siri officials. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, they have their connections to Cook Inlet Tribal Council and to, you know, many other institutions.
So it's kind of like daily who?
Yeah. I do want to point out, though, on this question of public office, we should acknowledge that Byron Mellott is now the lieutenant governor.
Excellent point.
The lieutenant governor.
Long time coming, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Daily Sambo Duro is with me and Jim LaBelle, and obviously we're talking about the urban native experience. And now I'd like to go to Lorraine, who's calling from Anchorage. Lorraine?
Hi, I appreciate the conversation that is going on, and I think it's definitely about time. There are plenty of issues, layers, historical trauma, etc., that affected our Native peoples, and just wanted to mention that. I appreciate the conversation that is happening.
Thank you, Lorraine. I agree, and we could do a better job of covering it, and just as we've been talking here today, have come up with a bunch of ideas for future shows, which I intend to pursue. You know, one thing that's happening as we get into our last few minutes here is that rural Alaska really is in a crisis in terms of the livability of Native communities. And as we see state revenues going down, that crisis is going to get worse. The ability of village schools to stay open is going to get harder. And we've already seen sort of a migration or an influx of people from rural Alaska to the cities, which has got to be a very difficult transition for a lot of people, especially those who really were involved in the subsistence lifestyle, which is, you know, pretty difficult or impossible if you're living here in town. Jim, have you seen some of that migration taking place, and what kind of adjustment do you think that is for folks?
I've heard of it anecdotally of people coming into Anchorage and Fairbanks and places like Juneau. I have to look at it from you have to go back and look at our laws and policies. Whenever state and federal government starts restricting our traditional access to our traditional foods to a point where some of the roles that men, for example, had were so restricted now that they're almost emasculated in terms of how do they really contribute to their society, even in the village. Mm-hmm. And so some of them don't have that that purpose. So they have to find purpose, and they find a way to leave so they can be productive or at least try to be.
I've talked to even, you know, my Outdoor Explorer talked to village folks who, because of climate change, are unable to hunt. Because of salmon problems in the Yukon, they're unable to fish. And so I totally understand what you're talking about. I think there's also economic problems where people don't have enough money to buy gas so they can hunt, right?
If you look at it, at one time, Native people had 100% of all of the fish and game. But if you look at fish, we're lucky if we have 3%, because now the 97% are going to commercial fishermen and sports fishermen. And the subsistence fishermen and families and communities are struggling with a smaller piece of the pie, especially when they're having to look out for agencies are having to look out for treaty obligations to Canada, or they're doing bottom fishing out in the Bering Sea and catching all that bycatch, and then restricting our own people from putting their nets in the water. I mean, to me, that's where the real crimes are.
Yeah. Daly, if this is a naive question, correct me, but it seems like people coming from small villages are coming a lot of times from fairly traditional Native lifestyles, where they may still be speaking Yupik or Nupiak. They may still be getting a large amount of their diet from you know, hunting and fishing and gathering. And when they come to the city, it would seem there'd be a pretty big sacrifice in that, and that the language is probably going to move to English. The food gathering is probably going to move to an 8 to 9 to 5 job. The use of time, the way you connect with others, Is that a crisis for Native culture, in your opinion, or is that something that we really need to be thinking about?
No, I think that that's exactly right. In fact, not long ago, I was cleaning out some archives and found a box of letters and copies of bills and other things that my grandparents collected, and what they were doing in this small metal box, I'm not sure. But what it represented, it was actually sad, to be honest. What it represented was their struggle to make it in an urban area, you know, to try to buy a tiny little piece of property, to build a home, to, you know, it was sad. It was like looking at this, realizing that this was a hard, hard thing to do. So today, 2016, and I'm talking about 1950s, 1960s. So 2016, and with the population of Anchorage, the diversity of Anchorage, the new stresses and pressures, also just the basic cost of living. It's not only difficult for Alaska Native people, it's just difficult for everybody, you know?
That's right.
but for Alaska Native people and that connection to the land, more often than not, what I see is, and then there are things that I practice myself, is do what you possibly can that maintains that connection, and reach out to those that you do have in order to maintain that connection. But
focus on it, yeah.
Yeah, but it is a struggle. And for our communities, it is a crisis because of what you pointed out earlier in terms of schools and education, that once a school has fewer than 10 students or 10 students or less, the school gets closed down. I mean, this in and of itself is a huge impact and a crisis for a traditional community.
And some legislators are wanting to raise that level.
Yeah, though they don't seem to have been able to pull that off. I guess that we just have about a minute left. Jim, do you want to add anything to what Daly was just saying about this maintaining of Native culture within the urban setting, how you do that?
Well, there is numerous things that go on in Anchorage that the general public don't always know about. Mm-hmm. There's potlatches, there's potlucks, there's conventions, annual meetings that bring people together. and also, I think there's some really good groups in Anchorage that are doing things to try to overcome or educate people about racism. First and foremost right now is an organization called ANDOR, Alaska Native Dialogue on Race and Ethnicity, operated by First Alaskans. I think they're doing a wonderful job. The other one is Bridge Builders, of which I used to be a member, and they're an organization that also tries to create understanding and respect for our cultures.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought them up. That is a positive, good, happy place to end, or the heavy conversation that I really, really enjoyed and learned a lot from. And I appreciate both of you for being here. Jim LaBelle, you were just hearing from Chugach, Alaska, founder and longtime community member, Daly Sambo-Duro, who is a UIA professor and representative of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And my name is Charles Wolforth. I thank you very much for being here. Next week, I'll be here talking about the VA. If you have VA issues, we have a deputy secretary who's going to be in the studio to answer some of those questions. So please tune in. Dave Waldron is our producer. Pat Yak is our chief content officer. Thanks for being with us.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.